Hi, this is Media Geek producer Paul Reismandel. This week's program was recorded during Home Station WEFT's Spring Pledge Drive. If you regularly listen to public or community radio, then you probably hear pledge drives every so often. That's when the program hosts and the DJs get on and ask the listeners to donate to help keep these nonprofit, non-commercial stations on the air. If you listen to Media Geek on your local community station like Radio Free Moscow, KRFP or KQRP in Salida, California, or maybe KRBS in Oroville, California, then I'd like you to consider giving a donation of your support to that station. Give them a call, look up their website, find out how you can help keep that great community resource in your own community going and strong. If you're listening to Media Geek on the internet or as part of the podcast, then I'd like you to consider giving a donation of support to Home Station WEFT, a non-commercial community radio station in Champaign, Illinois. If it weren't for WEFT, if WEFT didn't exist, there would be no Media Geek. If you give a donation to WEFT, I won't see any of the money. I do this as a purely volunteer, nonprofit enterprise. If there is no WEFT, there will be no Media Geek. So please go to weft.org on the internet, and if you can give some money, please do. Otherwise, if you are listening on a radio station like WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, then I'd like you to go to your local station, find out how you can give them your donation of support, because this is all about community and independent media. We're all in this together. It is all a nonprofit enterprise, and we rely on you, the listener, to keep it going. So however you get Media Geek, I hope that you will support it and keep it going. Now I hope you enjoy this edition of Media Geek.
There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reismandel, and I'm your host on today's program. Oh, we're going to look at net neutrality. We'll look at web radio. We're going to take another survey of many issues affecting our ability to communicate. With me in the studio is John Anderson, joining me yet again. And I think it's going to be a good one. You do want to stay tuned. Well, John, thanks for joining me again.
It's a pleasure, as always.
We had so much fun last week, we had to do it, because we clearly couldn't cover nearly everything
really
we wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I guess it was.
It is really back-to-back, wow. So make sure that gets onto your CV.
Yes.
One of the few back-to-back guests here on the Media.
You're a
Geek
whole
program.
Block on my CV now, man. It's
I'm
great.
About to, I think I'm going to try and induct you to be
you,
here
You constitute
week.
The radio print interviews section of my CV.
And that's because John, in addition to running the great website, DIYmedia.net, is also a doctoral student in the field of communications at the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois, specializing in areas like radio policy.
Yep.
What goes on at the in the Federal Communications Commission, what goes on in Congress, and how that affects our ability to communicate, our ability to get good information, because as I've contended here on the show, and I know you contend, all this stuff, it's not business news.
Mm-mm.
It's democracy news.
Yes. Unfortunately, democracy is being treated as a business at the place where these policies are being developed.
And being turned from one vote to $1.
Right. And it's the job of both media policy scholars, media activists on media policy issues specifically, but on a range of media issues, and platforms like community radio stations to talk about and actually create a space where this can be discussed as democracy news. Because it doesn't happen anywhere else.
I mean, I'm here doing this after having joined WEFT about 13 years ago. And, you know, while I had been exposed to public radio and I'd been involved in college radio, I'd never really been exposed to community radio at that time. And WEFT was a very eye-opening experience to me. And I'd never really heard things like, at that time, Pacifica Network News, or heard programs like Counterspin, which WEFT has been carrying. And, you know, while I knew there were a lot of things wrong with the mainstream commercial media, and I could start to articulate them, I didn't really get a sense for it and really understand it from that democratic standpoint until getting involved in community radio and seeing democratic radio in action and being a part of it, and then hearing these other viewpoints and learning the history of community radio and the history of Pacifica. And that's what spurred me on this journey. And after getting to a certain point, I felt like, well, I can't keep this to myself. I mean, so I need to share these things as I learn and investigate them. As I pay attention to, it's just me. It's my hobby in a way. And I pay attention. I learn about this stuff. I feel I have an obligation to share it. And that's the whole point of doing Media Geek here each and every week.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's, I hope that is something that you appreciate, but something that you enjoy.
The tool that you're actually hearing right now is the thing that actually inspired the information you're hearing over the tool. That's what you're saying.
Yes, in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, because I realized how
being
special
exposed
it was
to radio made you understand how important radio was to your media environment, and wanted you to make a change and make it better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, hence, you're on the air providing information we all need to know.
Stuff that I wish I'd known.
And it wouldn't have happened if WEFT had not existed.
No, and there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of stories, I think, of people who've either been through the station, been a part of the station, or were exposed to them. And every now and then we get that email or we get that phone call from somebody, and maybe they're back in town and they say, wow, it's been so great to tune in and hear WEFT because I moved to this place and we don't have a WEFT. We don't have something like it. Or they email from somewhere else and they realize they didn't know what they had until it was gone, until they moved away. But you're lucky here to have WEFT. I'm lucky. John is lucky here to have WEFT, to have this community radio enterprise going on for 25 years.
It has definitely been a life-changing experience for me to be involved as well.
Really?
Yes.
Because it's just been a couple of years here for
yes.
you.
But each community radio station has its own flavor. Mm-hmm. I've worked in other community radio stations before, and I've had a little bit of experience in the world of public radio. But each community radio station is unique, and it's because the product of the individuals that come together to occupy this frequency. And that's why I like community radio almost as much as I like pirate radio. And that's why I consider them to be so close as alliances, is because it really allows for a place where the individual can actually step out and address everyone else. And that's not a thing that can be done effectively in other parts of our information environment, including the new digital world that we're all, you know, quickly becoming a part of, including WEFT. But at the same time, as WEFT goes digital, you know, hopefully someday down the road we'll be implementing webcasting and things like that. That's going to just extend the unique nature of WEFT to a whole new audience, possibly. And that in itself has value, and that is something that needs financial support in order to develop and continue to deploy.
So the internet. Let's talk about the tubes. Let's talk about the tubes that are all clogged up because it's not a truck.
No, it's not a truck. Not a big truck.
An issue that I've been covering here in Media Geek now for, I don't know, it's been at least 18 months. I'm not even sure it's been 2 years, but something like that has been this issue of network neutrality,
mm-hmm.
which is really, it sounds like a big wonky issue.
No, it's very simple.
It's a very, very simple issue.
Basically, all network neutrality is that the concept is that if you pay for a connection to the internet, you shouldn't really have to pay for anything else that's freely available on the internet already. So once you pay the cost to your internet access provider to access to the internet, to a broadband, DSL, cable modem connection, whatever, wireless connection, once you've paid that fee that they charge you for connection to the network, you can do whatever else you want. If you want to buy information for sale on the network, you can do that too. You negotiate the price as a consumer between those folks and you. Otherwise, you can just connect to the net and freely communicate with anyone else who is similarly connected, which is everybody. What network neutrality is simply the idea that at various strategic points within what constitutes the internet, phone companies and cable companies want to set up toll charges. They want to set up spaces where, as traffic flows through, they can essentially monetize that portion of the network. Right now, all you do is pay for the jack in your wall to the connection somewhere near your house that connects to the phone or cable company's
big network. And sometimes you pay a little bit more to get a little faster connection.
You pay by the size of your pipe. You know, if you want 10 megabits or 3 megabits or whatever, you can pay a different fee. But once you pay for that connection, everything else is just wide open to you. Everything else is completely wide open. Access to the internet, the web is wide open. Access to peer-to-peer networks, wide open. Access to instant messaging networks, wide open. But what network neutrality, if it were not to be imposed as law, would essentially allow is phone companies to segregate those different sorts of traffics and charge you for effective delivery of them. It's essentially monetizing something that we have always had available for free, and they're just simply leveraging bottlenecks in the plumbing, in essence, to try to force us to pay more for service that we're already getting.
And right now, I mean, what the debate has happened is when a lot of groups got together, a lot of media reform groups and consumer groups, along with, you know, large companies like Google and Amazon have gotten along and said, well, if it's not a problem, let's go ahead and put this into law. Let's put this into policy.
And it used to be part of law. But phone and cable companies have essentially, through a series of lobbying efforts and subsequent rulings at the FCC, and most importantly in the federal courts, where they have challenged certain parts of telecom law, have effectively repealed all the provisions that relate to network neutrality. So they can turn the internet or the online broadband environment into a world wide web where free service is not defined as simply as it has been in the past by a one monthly surcharge fee that you pay to one place to get access.
And they keep saying, well, we're really not going to do that, you see. But and of course, the question is, well, if you're not, then why did you go
through all that
work to get the policy changes? And these are all policy changes that were, you know, that were easy to miss.
Yes.
That were all little things done incrementally, but towards this one big goal.
And now that network neutrality no longer exists anywhere in the law and nobody can point to it and say, you know, phone cable company X, you must do this way. They're starting to modify the parameters by which we use the internet in ways to condition us to pay for things we didn't do before. A perfect example of this are the bandwidth caps that customers of Comcast, who actually owns Insight Communications, and Insight just wholly sold out to. So all of us in the WEFT listening area will be Comcast customers soon. Comcast has these mysterious bandwidth caps that they put on people's broadband internet connections. Once you pay Comcast or Insight for a connection, you expect to get 10 megabits of throughput for as long as you want it.
And that's 10 megabits, which is like...
You've paid them for a 10 megabit pipe to send 10 megabits of data for whenever and however and you want. You got a 10 megabit lane that you've bought on their pipe. And they're saying, well, no, not actually. We don't have those 10 megabits for you. We've oversold our capacity. And if you use the pipe too much, then, you know, since we basically sold the same airline seat to you that we sold to this other passenger, we're going to bump you off the net for a while, unless you want to pay us more. And then we'll let you stay on the line and bump someone else off.
It's sort of like buying a big gulp. And then when you drink 20 ounces, having to come out and say, well, actually, no, we need to give that 12 ounces left in your cup to somebody else.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. You know, you thought you bought the big gulp, but you were actually just getting the little one. But we gave you the big gulp.
The big cup, right. Just, you know, it's not really all you can eat. Right. It's some of what you can eat.
So that's one thing that companies are doing in order to circumvent network neutrality is they're basically saying, well, there's only so much bandwidth you can have now. Broadband connections aren't
anymore. You know,
we changed the definition of what a broadband connection is. Sorry.
I mean, and you could be using your connection for purely legal and legitimate purposes. Maybe you've downloaded a lot of free podcasts.
Maybe you run a home business that requires a web presence, and you're doing some sort of, you know, online retail, and you take a lot of orders from people. Maybe you're someone like a neighbor of mine who sells comic book sets on eBay.
Yeah, you need to be on a lot, and that's part of your business. Enough. And you're paying for that, and you want to keep going, and that is this network neutrality. We've got about 10 stations, other community stations around the country. I mean, I do it for free. I do it on the internet. So, I mean, network neutrality affects me directly in that people need to be able to download the show. I need to be able to get my own internet access, which I do pay for. And I'm glad to pay, actually. I pay a little bit more to get better speed.
It would not be fair if Free Press paid an internet service provider more money to make my radio show download faster than your radio show. Mm-hmm. Both of our radio shows are important. They both have audiences that need to hear things, that want to hear things. They should have equal access to that radio show. But just because you're not supported by a big media reform group doesn't give me the right to have my show reach a wider audience by someone's ability to pay. That's what network neutrality means. Yeah. Paul and I are on an equal playing field when it comes to spreading our information around via the radio.
Yeah,
and it's as simple as that, and it's not a complicated issue at all. And the phone and cable companies are trying to make it seem incredibly complicated,
and so
just
now,
so that they can impose their own solutions.
Network neutrality is starting to get some traction finally in Congress.
Yeah, kind of.
But with what little traction is getting, and some Democratic lawmakers starting to come on board, there is a lot of opposition still coming from the telephone companies, and they're using some sneaky means. Using
a couple
groups
of them
that are, well, there's this term they call AstroTurf groups.
There's actually a couple of different ways this is being applied. Essentially, what an AstroTurf group is, a group that looks like it is from the grassroots but is not. It's basically a front of a couple of spokespeople portraying the image of representing a bunch of people that don't really exist, completely financed by corporate lucre. For example, there is this new report that came out of this brand new group called the American Consumer Institute. That doesn't sound controversial at all. I mean, the American Consumer Institute, wow, they say that if you impose a network neutrality law, it's going to cost $67 billion more a year for broadband in America. We're all going to suffer and rates are going to go through the roof. Well, what you don't know about the American Consumer Institute, though, is that the guy who runs it, the one guy who runs it, is the former chief economist of the phone company now known as Verizon. See? That's not grassroots. That's not supporting of a public opinion. That is complete and utter BS, gussied up to be seeming like it's coming from the grassroots, and it's not. Another thing that is happening is people in Oregon, the state of Oregon, have started getting these automated political telemarketing calls that are basically asking them to call one of their senators, Gordon Smith, I think, and tell him that he should not support any effort to legislate network neutrality because it's bad, 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 and it's a complicated issue and Congress doesn't need to get its mitts into it. We don't know who's paying for those calls. We suspect that it is someone involved with a phone or cable company or an AstroTurf group. But it does... It does bear mentioning that Oregon's other senator, Ron Wyden, original sponsor of the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, the bill that is pending to restore network neutrality to its rightful place in telecom law. As far as the bills go that are pending in Congress, things are actually moving really slowly, disappointingly slowly on this.
Well, there they're spending all their time on the Iraq
war spending bill and all kinds of other stuff. There are 10 sponsors to the Internet Freedom Preservation Act in the Senate. And those people all signed on very quickly. There is no companion legislation as yet introduced in the House.
Okay.
Supposedly that's coming this summer, but it hasn't happened yet. And come on, people in D.C., let's get on this. This is an easy issue. It's simple. The bills are written.
And the reason why the phone companies are using these AstroTurf groups to look grassroots is because the support for network neutrality is heavily grassroots and heavily broad-based.
There is a coalition of groups called Save the Internet, who have a website, savetheinternet.com, which is was created by Free Press, that has put together a petition that has several hundred groups ranging from the Gun Owners of America and the Christian Coalition to MoveOn.org, all on board supporting the principle of network neutrality. 1.6 million actual human citizens have signed a petition in support of network neutrality. Musicians and bands across the country are holding summer gigs this year to raise awareness of the issue. It is very much a grassroots issue, and there's no way AT&T can mobilize that kind of passion for their penchant to make money.
So they
got to make it up. They got to create it. But the authentic, real-deal information is out there. You can find it. It's available, and this is one of the spots. Media Geek and WEFT. It's one of the spots.
That's what I've been trying to do, because the internet is great. The internet has changed things, and you know, it sounds very obvious, but yet it is very true. And one of the great changes has been the ability for people to communicate on a scale that previously did require huge amounts of capital.
Absolutely.
You know,
internet has in some ways revolutionized radio already.
Absolutely.
How do you think we get things like free speech, radio news, and democracy now?
Yeah, so
how
much
do you
of
think
it
we get a lot of our programming that we carry in the WEFT couriers.
And that's how they can do a free speech radio news, because just 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it would have been impossible to put together a daily grassroots global newscast, because just simply getting that story to free speech radio news in the same day would have been required going over a telephone line,
satellite,
or
uplink,
renting very expensive satellite time or very expensive digital phone lines. It would have meant stories were several days old, probably sent by tape over the mails, which from some regions of the world might never make it because the mail system isn't nearly, you know, reliable, or it's war torn and there is no mail.
I've had the privilege of being able to start two syndicated radio news programs and continue working in radio for the last 7 years, all because of the internet.
Yeah, that was Workers Independent News.
Yes, and Media Minutes. If it weren't for the internet, I wouldn't have had a job.
Yeah.
The internet is very real, and it affects mediums beyond just the internet.
And it's very important. It is
useful.
And a lifeline to democracy, is, you know, the quote I'm going to misuse, but freedom of the press is only important to those who own a press. And the internet has made all of us press owners. Anyone who can get on the internet some way, whether or not you own a computer, whether or not you own your own internet line, whether you can go to a library or an internet cafe or however you can do it, it has changed things. And that's why I try to cover the policy, try and look at what is changing it, and look underneath. And when network neutrality gets covered in newspapers, it's there on the business page.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't show up on page one, doesn't show up in national, doesn't show up in U.S. politics. It shows up in the business page. And we say, no, it's not just money. Of course it's money. But it is about democracy, it's about politics, it's about our very right to communicate.
Thanks to John Anderson for sitting in with me on this edition of Media Geek. The reason why that runs a little short is that it's pledge drive time here at WEFT, the home station of Media Geek, and we did not want to make you listen to all of our pledge pitches, but I do want to say that if you're listening to Media Geek on a community radio station in your city or town, definitely consider giving them a call or going to their website and giving them a donation of your support. All community radio exists because of listeners like you. If you're listening to the Media Geek podcast on the internet, then I encourage you to go to weft.org and to give a donation of your support to home station WEFT, which helps keep Media Geek going. None of that money goes to me, Paul Rees-Mandel, the producer of Media Geek. It all goes to the home station, a nonprofit station, to keep things running. But if you're listening on a community radio station like Radio Free Moscow, then I'd like you to go ahead and give them a pledge, a donation of your support. So here's a little news in the time we have left. There are two seemingly contradictory messages that we keep hearing about internet in the United States. On the one hand, we hear that the growth of so-called broadband internet is the engine behind the explosion of video and multimedia on sites like YouTube. On the other, there's strong data that shows the U.S. is way behind other industrialized nations in terms of the speed and coverage of broadband. So what's right? Well, it's all true. One thing about the word broadband is that what one person calls broadband, someone else might not. According to the FCC, an internet line that would be considered slow in Finland or South Korea can be categorized as broadband in the U.S. Yet that U.S. broadband line running at just 200 kbps or kilobits per second is barely fast enough to provide VHS quality real video in real time. And you can forget about that high def video we keep being promised. In a hearing of the House Internet Subcommittee on May 17th, Chairman Ed Markey of Massachusetts let FCC Chairman Kevin Martin know that he's not happy with the state of American broadband. To put things straight, Markey is drafting a bill called the Broadband Census of America Act that would define broadband as internet service running at speeds of 2 megabits or more, nearly 10 times what the FCC lets pass as broadband now. At 2 megabits, you can start thinking about the real-time, high-definition video, high-quality audio and video chat, and super-fast downloads that South Koreans take for granted now. Predictably, the broadband industry, which likes to think that 3/4 of a megabit is screaming fast, weren't so happy with Markey's proposal. However, internet subcommittee members were very interested to hear from Brian Mefford, the CEO of Connect Kentucky, a successful public-private partnership that has expanded broadband internet availability in that state from 60 to 90% in just 2.5 years. By the end of 2007, all Kentucky households should be able to get broadband internet access at speeds of at least 768 kilobits per second, or about 0.75 megabit. While the FCC is hearing criticisms from Democratic lawmakers that it isn't being stringent enough, the commission is hearing a very different story from one industry lobby. Kyle McSlarrow, the head of National Cable and Telecommunications Association, told the Media Institute that the FCC needs to be seriously curtailed, and the government needs to stop most regulations, including must-carry rules that require cable providers to give customers access to local channels. McSlarrow didn't forget to take aim at network neutrality either, urging an end to efforts to reinstate it as the law of the land. He justified his demands based upon the argument that a, quote, fundamental change, end quote, has occurred in the marketplace as a result of the internet, satellite, and broadband technologies. Yet McSlarrow doesn't seem to want to acknowledge the fact that his industry isn't exactly making friends with consumers to begin with. The same week that McSlarrow made his comments, a consumer survey found that cable and satellite TV have the lowest satisfaction scores of any industry in the country, with consumers believing that cable has, quote, an element of monopoly-like pricing, end quote. Across the U.S., the cost of basic cable jumped 5% last year and almost 100% over the last 10. The lowest scoring company on the survey, Comcast, saw their revenue grow by 12% last year. And that's some of what's going on in our media environment. Thanks for tuning in to Media Geek. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate 969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.